But I know that you made Charles make the news, stand up and listen to the podcast. Night Hawks, episode 85, Digstown. In 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the Nighthawks podcast, the cinema-centric podcast for people out there in the world that, I don't know, they like to stay up late and watch movies. I think that's a lot of people.
Fighting. I'm going to watch a fight.
And yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome ringside at the beautiful Nighthawks Casino in downtown Las Vegas. Everybody here in the auditorium and everybody watching at home on pay-per-view, welcome. Tonight is the night to fight.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get to Texas.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Oh, I should... Hold on. I'll be me for a second.
Okay.
I'm Matt. I'm the other guy.
And I am Trevor, and we're here bringing you the hot ringside action from 1992.
Yeah, we're here at the Spanish announce table. No, it's the regular one. Have I ever told you about the verb Sabu?
Huh.
Okay, so there's an old pro wrestler called Sabu.
Uh-huh.
And when we were kids, he would have been in the alternate, like, extreme wrestling promotion that was not the name brand one.
Uh-huh.
Right? And Sabu's gimmick was Sabu always threw you through the furniture or went through it himself. And as one knows, the members of the Insane Clown Posse are wrestling fans, right?
I believe they got their start in wrestling, did they not?
Yes. And so... one of their songs contains the lyric, "I will Sabu your mama through a coffee table."
As one does.
Meaning you would seize upon the person's mother and thrust them vigorously through the living room furniture. And that is what it means to Sabu somebody. Now, you can mock that if you want. You can say, "I've never really heard of that pro wrestler." You can say like that, "Well, they're just white trash," whatever. But you're not a verb yet. No, you're not a verb. I'm not a verb. Just Sabu and Buckminster Fuller.
Goddamn,
dude. Yeah, I made up for my ICP joke with a really, really, really out there one. So we're talking about you hate to call something your favorite when it's so dark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? You hate to go like... One time I told somebody Ruthless People was one of my favorite movies. It's Danny DeVito and Bette Midler, right? Just horrible to each other, but it's really funny. It's got a lot of good, like, roast humor in it. Or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is one of my dad's favorites. And you're just like, do I want to endorse this ugliness? But a movie I like for its cleverness, we're watching Digstown tonight with Lou Gossett Jr., James Woods, a couple other folks, Tex Cobb.
The unparalleled Oliver Platt.
And it was the breakthrough role for a young Heather Graham, I believe.
This movie came out in August of 1992 of a particular interest. I believe Evander Holyfield was the heavyweight boxing champion of the world at the time of the release of this movie. Later that year, he would lose that title to Riddick Bowe, who would then be stripped of that title after refusing to fight Lennox Lewis in December of 1992. Big year for boxing.
Yeah, a lot of craziness. That was the last great run of really ridiculous sort of, what would you call them, tabloid boxing champions.
Yeah, because before Holyfield, that was Buster Douglas, and before that was for many years, Mike Tyson.
Well, yeah, the infamous Iron Mike Tyson, who really only lost to Father Time and the
American justice
system.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we go on, we should kind of disclaim this one. Gets a little rough in a couple spots. It is a kind of Southern Gothic tale.
Uh-huh.
And it does contain some good old-fashioned racism.
Yep, and some...
Including a hard N-bomb, if that's not your thing. There's only one, and it is summarily punished.
Boy, is it ever. But also worthy of note, Dickstown, again, came out in 92, and so that means... it stars James Woods, who we should probably just get out at the front of the episode and say James Woods is one of the many performers who has been implicated in sexual abuse in the Me Too movement. And James Woods has also been known to espouse some pretty controversial political views. And so that's something that if that's on your radar, if that's something... We're not going to hold it against you guys if you don't see Dickstown because you can't get down with James Woods. We understand. And we're not going to look down our nose at you, obviously, if the separation of art from artist is sufficient enough for you that you feel you can watch or would enjoy. And honestly, if you knew nothing else about James Woods other than he's in this movie, it's a good performance, you know, and talented people also can be problematic and even horrible people. It's kind of an uncomfortable subject. It's not really what the podcast is about, although it is something we feel that our listeners would want to know so they can make a better choice in how they spend their movie dollar.
Well, let me say this about that. The staff of the Nighthawks podcast will definitely not hold it against you if you do not want to pay good money to watch this movie. If instead you elect to go to the lake that day and ride an inner tube.
Okay.
If you'd rather recreate by having you go ride a tube than pay to watch this movie, we understand. Probably good, you know, get out on the water, get some sun, get some vitamin D while you are tubing.
Uh-huh. I think I'm picking up what you're putting down.
I'm just saying that it's okay for our audience to have diverse hobbies.
Yeah. You know, and the best part about when you tube is that there's generally no cost. It's, you know, you're basically paying for infrastructure at that point.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a public resource, although you have to ask yourself if we use free stuff too much, what will happen to profit stuff? But this once... If you'd rather go tubing, we understand.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're... Pirate it. Do what you gotta do. We get it, whichever way. But I mean,
yeah.
He only gets a third of a penny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We have thresholds. It's the reason we haven't covered... all I'm saying. You better let that one marinate. You can cut that.
We are a proud member of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network family of podcasts. And Matt, we have been with the Sweeties for a year now. So a bit of a milestone. Be sure to listen to the other shows on the network. We've got, there's the Push My Button podcast, which focuses on the video game industry. We've also got Geek Parenting Podcast, which is a podcast for people to catch up on their geekness when they're busy also dealing with their young brood. So check those out. And I think you can find us, the Nighthawks podcast, on Spotify, Podomatic, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, iTunes. Oh, no, we can't do iTunes anymore. It's not called iTunes anymore. I think it... What the hell is it over on that? Is it Apple Podcasts? Is that what the preferred nomenclature is now?
I don't know. I didn't even know about all that. I don't, did I miss a memo?
I believe the iTunes brand, at least as a brand for selling music, is sunsetting.
Well, we're on the Apple thing.
Yeah, we are on Apple's podcast service. Find us on Facebook. We enjoy hearing from y'all, and we are active over at the Facebook. Great way to get in touch with us. And if you have an idea for a show... we're looking for ideas. I mean, Matt, the hardest part of this show is actually getting us to sit down and agree on what we're going to cover in a given episode. So why not make them do the work for it? They know what they want. They know what I'm sorry. I'm not talking to you right. I know that I also hate it when people like talk over me like I'm not there. But please, dear audience, just bear with me. But seriously, they know what they want. Why don't they tell us?
I don't know.
Yeah, this logic checks, man.
They're shy.
I'm shy, too. I guess I can. You know, I got a little off my keel there, audience at home. I'm sorry. We'd love it if you reached out. This is a safe and welcoming environment, and no way should be considered threatening. Did that work?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, you weren't even really, like, over to threatening yet. I don't know. Like,
so, Matt, by way of a spoiler curtain, this movie, I'm just gonna say it right now so it's out there, shares a lot of DNA with something like The Sting. And in that vein, there's a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot of things that the reason that we're talking about this movie is we want to talk about some of these plot devices. That means you're probably going to want to watch this movie through some avenue before you catch the episode. But we're not going to be giving a formal spoiler warning on this one.
Yeah, this definitely has some reveals in it. It's an older movie. If you're generally in the habit of taking our word about the movie and watching it, go ahead and stop now and watch it.
Yeah, this would be a good one to hit cold. And actually, you know, hitting this cold, that's something we're going to talk about. Because, Matt, this is the first time I had seen this. This was on your short list of movies that Trevor needs to see. And
well, yeah, I mean, it's a heist movie. It's a hustle movie. It's a Southern Fried movie. It's got Oliver Platt in it.
I do love Oliver Platt.
You know, he is he is in your wheelhouse, thespianically speaking.
Yeah, you know, not so much anymore that we've both gotten older, but I used to get a lot of physical resemblance comparisons to Oliver Platt. And acutely to this movie, as a matter of fact.
Definitely, mostly the beard, man. When you were baby-faced, so was he in this. So.
Two things we never joke about here in Digstown, Mr. Kane. Our boxing and our betting.
I never heard of no Honey Roy Palmer.
Could take on any 10 of you in a day.
Nobody can take 10, man.
Any 10, any day.
I'd bet 1,000 on it.
But would you bet 2,000 bucks on it?
I got $10,000 against your 1,000.
How's about your $100,000 against my 10,000?
You're not serious.
Roy's in, right? I mean,
I haven't asked him yet.
I know you're here to try and pitch me on something, but I'm off the con, man. I'm out complete. Forever.
All right.
No. What do you mean, all right?
I mean, if you're not interested, you're not interested.
Pick me up at 8.
How old is this boy?
48.
10 men in 24 hours? He ain't gonna last 10 seconds.
Now, you fighters, you do exactly what I say, you make $1,000.
Emily, I need your help. Kind of information that can get you killed.
Dear Lord, give us the strength to tear this man limb to limb.
So we have an ensemble here. We have James Woods, Bruce Dern. We've covered most of them.
God bless you, Bruce Dern.
Who'd we miss? We miss the most important man in the universe, the world's greatest gift to the stage and screen, Tex Cobb. Tex Cobb of Uncommon Valor and
Fletch Lives.
Yeah. Infamous, I believe, for being on the receiving end of a beating that made Howard Cosell quit boxing.
I did not know that. Does he have a boxing history?
Yeah, Tex Cobb was a real life fighter. Yeah.
See, he's one of those actors, and especially if you've watched a lot of movies from this era, we're talking early '90s, late to mid '80s. Tex Cobb did a lot of character work where he played, you know, usually some kind of big brutish muscle.
Tex Cobb's professional boxing record is 42-9 with 35 knockouts. He is actually a good boxer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He is 9-2 in professional kickboxing as well.
No kidding.
Yeah.
He's a big dude. Well, I don't know. Do you have his stats right there? Maybe he's just Hollywood big.
What I'm looking at here says 6'3", 215.
So taller and leaner than I. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's what he probably weighed when he probably had to be a light heavyweight. It's the division he fought in. I would say modern acting Tex Cobb probably walks around with a few more burritos in him than that. Because, you know, the tacos aren't good in Alay.
You're not wrong. I mean, I don't want to be that guy, but you're not wrong.
No, I had it wrong. The Houston Astrodome, Cobb was defeated in a unanimous decision by Larry Holmes, who won all 15 rounds on 2 of 3 scorecards. The one-sidedness of the fight, which came 13 days after the bout between Ray Mancini and Duduk Kim that resulted in Kim's death, horrified sportscaster Howard Cosell so much he vowed never to cover another professional match, which Cobb jokingly referred to as my gift to the sport of boxing. When prodded further regarding Cosell's remarks, Cobb said, "Hey, if it gets him to stop broadcasting the NFL, I'll go play football for a week." asked if he would consider a rematch, Cobb said he did not think Holmes would agree, as his hands could not take it. That is from Maxim, March 2000, page 84, cited and thus in play.
All right, it's finally over. Wasn't worthy of commentary in those last 5 rounds, which is why poor man is still smiling, and look how battered and beaten he is. What is achieved by such as this? Larry's not proud. He did his job, but he's not proud. He's a fine, decent man. He can't be happy about this.
In an interview, he was asked how he could fight someone whose arms were a foot longer than his, and to which he replied, "Oh, it seemed that way to you too." That one is, unfortunately, those quotes are unsubstantiated. They're probably from, I imagine, a radio editor interview.
Uh-huh.
They're probably from the post-fight on the match.
Well, taking a look at our movie, Tex Cobb, which he plays actually a minor role in, James Woods plays Gabriel Kane, who is kind of he's a smooth-talking con man. And we're introduced to him on his last day in prison. He's never one to miss an opportunity. Kane is running grifts while he's in prison, and he starts working on a grift as soon as he's released.
Well, this is a brilliant piece of characterization, because what we're shown is that he is helping other prisoners escape. He knows how to walk out of the prison.
Uh-huh.
But rather than use it himself to get out of his short sentence, he's using it to help people with longer sentences escape for a fee so that he has money when he gets out, which demonstrates sort of a foresightedness and an ability to endure a little bit of punishment to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
That are the soul of what he proceeds to set up.
Well, and it does set up his cunning. This guy is really slick. He is a mover. He's a shaker. He's a con man. And he's played dialed to the nines by James Woods, who, I don't know, man, maybe the guy is a dickhead, but you know what? He's a dickhead in this movie, and it plays. So.
And then, of course, he has, like, when he gets paroled, he's arranged for a woman. A gorgeous woman pulls up in a convertible, and he gets in the driver's seat, and then she ducks down out of sight, implying that she's performing an act upon him as he pulls away, and he throws a little salute to the guards as they watch him pull away, and one of the guards looks at the other ones and goes, "Man, what a stud!" So he leaves being idolized by his jailers, and that's the 10-minute introduction we get to this guy. Although it is also made clear that the warden knows he's up to some shit and is not his friend.
In the 18 years I've been running Winfield, there only been 6 escapes, 5 of them since you arrived here. Like little old Alex Dupree up and disappeared last night. What do you think about that, Mr. Kane?
I think the important thing is not to take it as a rejection of you personally. You know, Warden, I owe you an apology. The guy said your clip was full of blanks. I didn't know they meant your gun.
I don't carry blanks. Yeah, that was clumsy of me. It scared me. Did it scare you? No, you're smart, Kane. How is it they ever caught a boy as smart as you?
Well, Warden, let's just say you might want to change careers and decide to sell phony art to rich people. You want to make sure your painter doesn't use acrylics on 18th century English landscapes.
But I'll remember that, Mr. King. I will. And you remember this. I'm going to find out how you've been doing it. And before you release this...
The distraction for the escape was a prison boxing fight between his friend Wolf, who is Tex Cobb's character, and a guy from like the Hispanic gang in the prison, who's just this terrifying looking kind of MS-13 looking guy. And they're fighting. The brawl is what distracts the guards for the guy to get out.
Mm-hmm.
When he talks to Wolf after the fight, before he himself gets paroled, Wolf gives him his shirt and says, "Take this to my dogs when you get to town." So we know that Digstown is Wolf's hometown. And so he goes to Digstown where he meets Fitz, who is already doing what?
He's hustling people at the pool hall.
Excuse me. He is expressly not hustling at pool, remember?
One minute, 19 seconds.
That's good. That's very good. He's good.
You're good.
You wanted to just save the effort and concede?
No. I've done that good before. Question is, can I do it now?
So, yeah, they happen into Digstown, and this is a place where boxing... This is like the little small town from Varsity Blues, only instead of being obsessed with football, they're obsessed with boxing. And
it is the hometown of one Charles Macomb Diggs, fictively speaking, one of the last great white hopes in boxing. Heavyweight champion some years before the events of the story commenced.
Now that we're introduced to Charlie Diggs, one heated night after not hustling at the pool hall, Fitz makes kind of a boast that this relative unknown fighter that nobody's heard of except him can not only do an impossible feat that was accomplished by Charlie Diggs, but he can actually do it better by 100%.
The exact allegation, I believe, is that while sparring, he would often, quote-unquote, put away as many as five men.
The boast is made that this relative unknown, who never got his shot, can actually best the 10 best men in Digstown. Thus, we enter in one of the select men of the city. He is kind of he's a moneyed businessman, and he is also the former manager for Charlie Diggs. And so there's this launching series of big money bets between this guy, John Guillon, who's played by Bruce Dern, and Fitz, who is Oliver Platt. Well, in walks Fitz's confederate in James Woods, pretending that they don't know each other, and he walks in as kind of a financier for this bet because Bruce Dern and James Woods had run afoul of each other earlier in the evening.
There's a boxing gym in town, right?
Mm-hmm.
So James Woods goes and he drops a little money gambling on boxing, right? And then what's happened is this Fitz guy, he has hustled Guillaume's son out of a vintage car playing pool. And he goes very flippantly says he'll go like double or nothing on this Digstown bet, not thinking anybody in the bar can cover it. And so the boy's dad pipes up that he'll cover the bet, and he's got deep pockets. And this is all by design. This is their engineered goal, is to get them into this, covering this bet. And then gradually over the escalation of the movie, they're constantly going, you know, nothing or double, Jack, and upping the stakes. And until they get basically as much as possible on the line. And so I love it because, like, you know, anytime a prop bet gets serious, you know, like there was an infamous prop bet where the poker player Amarillo Slim, he bet, I believe, Bobby Riggs that he could beat him at ping pong, provided he was allowed to provide the paddles. And Riggs agreed, provided both paddles were identical. They dickered on the terms of the bet, and it was to be held in 6 months or whatever, and be in such an exposition hall and blah, blah, blah. And when Amarillo Slim showed up, He had two 6-inch cast iron skillets, and he'd been practicing with his. And so he won the bet. And so this is very like that. There is a scene where they sit down in a boardroom.
I love this scene too.
And go, now that this got serious and we're betting $250,000 here, we're going to sit down and talk about just what is a Digstown man. What is any 10 Digstown men? What is a day? I said he could do it in a day. At one point he says, well, Digstown's the county seat. So I'm saying a Digstown man is anyone who lives in the county, not the city. And he says, well, then fine. A day is 24 hours, not 12. You know? and they engineer all this stuff, and they go deeper and deeper on the bet. And then Gabriel brings in mobsters to back his play. So to get a line of credit, he brings in some mobsters from Florida.
Yeah, because he's fresh out of jail, and he's got some money from bailing people out. But like, this is a serious wager by the end of this movie.
Yeah, and so they have the mob escrow, and the mob is also his credit. And the mob's going to kill him if he blows the bet, right? They're gonna collect by kneecapping him.
Mm-hmm.
And so after everything is all said and done, and after we've established that all this money is riding on Honey Roy Palmer winning this fight.
That's Lou Gossett Jr., by the way, who we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah. So... after everything's shaken on and agreed to, then James Wood goes to, Gabriel goes to Honey Ray Palmer's house to ask him if he'll do it.
Which, again, is just peak character building. Like,
and I love it. I love it because he just comes in and he says, hey, I got a business proposition for you. He goes, I don't want to hear it. And he goes, okay, then we can just have dinner. And they just have a nice civil dinner. And after dinner, Roy makes some calls. And finds out on his own about the deal and who's financing it. And he goes, and he just, he shows up and he's, and basically the gist of it is he wasn't going to do it. Then he found out that he had to rescue Gabe. And as soon as he has to rescue Gabriel, then he's going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Once he's out of his house and away from his wife and he puts on his old boxing gear and he shaves his head, you know?
Yeah.
then all of a sudden he's like, yeah, he didn't really have to twist my arm that hard. But they had to put on a little bit of a show for the wife, and then he went along with it, which is his characterization of him,
uh-huh.
Like realizing that he actually has been a willing 50-50 participant in all these hustles that they've done in the past, which I think is important, too, because it shows that he's, like, more voluntary than he's set up to be at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's also important to point out that neither side in this is playing on the level. It's kind of a weird, it's like if the Music Man had a versus mode, and so it's Fitz, Kane, and Honey Roy Palmer, and they're kind of our trio of protagonists, and they're trying to connive and con their way to the big fight night. They're cutting deals, they're trying to gain the upper hand, and they're playing against Bruce Dern's Guillaume character. And Guillaume is also trying to cut deals, trying to get, you know, trying to get an unfair edge, you know.
His vesting in particular is that he impresses it on the gentleman that he will not under any circumstances be losing this bet, and so they will follow his marching orders.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like his... his strategy is to have, like, well, the first guy is just going to work on his left eye.
Now, you fighters, the first two rounds, you do exactly what I say, you make $1,000. Guaranteed. After that, I don't care. Go for the grand prize, knock the man out, that's up to you. Buck, we're starting with you because of this right hand. I want you to work on his left eye. I want you to cut it, knock it out. I don't care how. Just tear it out of his head. You got that?
Mm-hmm. I'll knock it out for sure.
You're next. You're our lefty. You work on the right eye. Do you understand that? This man reads nothing but Braille from now on because of you. Fair enough?
Which brings us to you, Billy.
You get inside here, okay? Start working on his solar plexus. He can't hurt you, son. You're going to have a headgear on.
Yes,
okay?
Sir.
Sam, not you. You get the honors. How about that, huh? All those years, the lack of discipline I was on you all the time about too many roundhouses, now they're going to pay off. The man's midsection is going to be broken. He's going to be blind as Tidwell's goat. Now... you use the roundhouses, and you knock them down and out once and for all, right?
You can bet on that.
I already have.
And what unfolds from there is just a clinic on the various ways by which one may rig or manipulate the odds of a boxing match. It's just we see for the 10 fights, we see basically 9 separate scams. And then, of course, the big reveal, without going into too much detail, I don't know how far we want to go, but essentially the reveal is that for reasons, one of the fights is 100% on the level. It is a legitimate pro boxer that actually fought Honey Roy Palmer when they were both young and strong. Mm-hmm. And this guy was the young lion that kicked him out of boxing in the first place. And now they're here. And now they're getting a rematch 20 years on. And the other thing we kind of find out over time, it's not really a spoiler, but we also find out that the final fight of the Charles Diggs, the town's namesake, was rigged by Guillaume. That, mm-hmm. that Diggs was supposed to take a fall, that he drugged him, but Diggs was too stubborn to basically be knocked out. So he took a standing loss and was badly beaten, and that's why he's not well. And we see Diggs as an invalid. He's in a wheelchair.
Yeah,
and they bring him.
What is revealed is that Guillaume, who was Diggs, was he his manager or his trainer?
I think it was his manager. I think the actual trainer is more the guy that like blows the whistle when you run, you know?
Right. And
but
so
he was the business guy.
At the point where Charles Makeham Diggs is at the peak of his career, there is more money to be played on the long shot loss than there is to be gotten from like a legitimate win. And so he asks Diggs to take a fall. Diggs lets pride get in the way. So Bruce Dern fixes the fight by putting essentially knockout drops in Diggs' water. And despite everything, he never falls down. He doesn't succumb to the drugs, but he's also badly beaten in the ring, and as a result has some functional problems.
We see at one point, we see Diggs kind of acknowledge Roy a little bit, but I don't believe he doesn't speak a line. He just watches from his wheelchair as things unfold. And at one point, I think his maid says that he has good days and bad days, but we never see a good day. The most salient part of this gambling transaction is that Guillaume underwrote the local betting in town. And so, unbeknownst to the townspeople, when they bet on Diggs and lose, they lost all their land, petty cash. You know, they lost all their holdings mm-hmm. that were wagered to Guillaume through an intermediary. And at one point, the farm they train on, even the farm that Roy and Fitz train on, they rent it from a farmer. And the farmer says, you know, they say it was hard to find some place to rent. He says, yeah, not too many people own their own land anymore. Most of them sharecrop for Guillaume. He says, how come you don't? And he goes, because one night in 1980, whatever, when Charles Makeham Diggs was fighting, I went fishing.
Yeah.
Implying that he skipped the fight, bet nothing, and so lost nothing. But yeah, so we just see this good, you know, and like it's just this sort of interplay of all these knowing con men. We're like, Guillaume Camp sends a spy to watch Roy run. James Woods catches the spy in the bushes and says, well, how's he doing? He says, well, he's running about a 7-minute mile. He says, why don't you put down 9? and gives him a $100 bill.
Uh-huh. You
know? And so it's just this, just rendered so innocent by the fact that they're both doing it. Like it's such a game.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hit a point. There is a midpoint turnaround where the Honey Roy Palmer camp has paid off one of the other fighters. And he gives a very unconvincing performance. And so the Guillaume team goes down to his locker, finds his money, and they know that he should not have, he's a poor farm boy. He should not have $5,000 in a manila envelope. They kind of very quickly figure out what happened. After this guy's unconvincing fight, they kill him. The other thing that happens is Wolf turns up dead, allegedly killed in prison. And we ultimately find out that Guillaume was connected to both of these killings. And at that point, that is the impetus for Roy to take the events personally and finish the last fight that he has to do,
mm-hmm.
which is the one that is not Rick.
This is an old favorite of yours, you said. Do you have any particular memories about where it happened into your life?
You know, I just rented this one day. I think I was actually kind of doing a little 80s action night, and I had probably a couple other Lou Gossett Jr. movies and rented this kind of unbeknownst.
Well, and you're a fight fan, aren't you? I mean, like, this is kind of in your wheelhouse anyway.
A little bit, yeah. Like not, I'm not a huge boxing fan specifically. I'm more of a stand-up, modern-day namby-pamby wrestling fan. It's a really fun movie, and it has that quality that, like, a good old-school parlor mystery has, where everything is there for you. Like, there are reveals in this that are set up in the beginning, and the red flag is there for you. And you watch it, and you go, oh, that's what that was at the beginning.
Right, right. There was a couple of those we were talking about off mic that I ended up watching this movie twice. And there were definitely things the second time around that I picked up on that I did not grab on the first round. And having a retrospective look on this movie actually really helped. And so you get the kind of shock and awe of the reveal at the end of this one and how deep and tightly wound this actual grift goes. And there's also just the skillful setup of it. So you go, you watch the movie, you see where it's going, and then you can actually go back a second time and see how the movie got there. This was a first-time watch for me. I think it's a perfect streaming title. It's fun, it's funny, it's engaging. It's not a franchise, it stands alone. You don't need any particular knowledge coming in or going out. I don't know that this is one that I'd necessarily pay full price on a retrospective screening to watch for the first time, but I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. I think it shares a lot of DNA with a lot of other films. And looking at some historic reviews of this, I did notice that Leonard Maltin kind of accused it of being a little derivative. And I think that's probably a fair criticism. But even if this is not the pinnacle of this type of movie, it's a long way from the bottom tier.
I think that was probably a really fair criticism when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were more of this type of movie in circulation. I haven't seen a good kind of con hustle thing like this in a little bit, except maybe the Ocean's 11 franchise. Like, a good one.
Which way?
Like, I mean, I know, yeah, there's a few out there.
The franchise is kind of a diminishing returns thing, but
I think what I like about it is how, like you said, the second time through, like how much you realize, like, okay, mini spoiler curtain here.
Hide it.
But like we were talking off mic about, so in the very beginning, the distraction for the fight, right, is that Wolf is fighting the number one contender from the Mexican gang, right? Well, then we don't actually see, I don't believe. Oh yeah, we do see the result of that fight. Is kind of no, they don't show it, do they?
I think they just kind of cut to Tex Cobb laid up
in
the cell.
They just cut to Tex Cobb laid up in the cell.
Yeah.
And so, like, expositionally, what I like about this is that over the course of the movie, the backstory gets filled in for you. And you get that, like, oh, Tex Cobb is Gabriel's cellmate, and he's sat around all night telling Gabriel, I got this sister, and there's this scumbag, and in town he owns half the town. And then it turns out that Tex Cobb was one of Diggs' sparring partners, and he's one of the only people alive that knows that Guillaume drugged him.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Gabriel gets mad and he says that to Guillaume, that's when Guillaume puts together that they all know each other.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because the only person that could know is someone that Wolf told. And so you get like the layer of backstory, and then you get the mental image of the guy sitting there in the dark cell planning it at night. And you get like, and then at the end, Honey Roy fights Hammerhead Hagen, the ringer that was brought in. And through an earlier contrivance, like, one of the fighters doesn't ever get in the ring. He quits without, he pretends he's afraid to fight.
Well, it's a shady move on the part of Guillaume.
Yeah, he convinces his son, who instigated the whole thing, right? He says, you're going to get him up, and you're going to get him, and you're going to look in the eye, and then you're just going to walk out like you're disgusted with him, and he's not even worth fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Which, to the audience, looks like he chickened out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then at the very end, he says, all right, You did a good job against Hammerhead Hagen. Nobody thought you could beat him. Get ready for the 10th fight. He says, what do you mean, the 10th fight? We just did 10.
One was
a
forfeit.
That was number 10. Yeah. There's no. And he says, no, one was a forfeit. The guy never got in the ring. The paper says they have to get in the ring for the fight to start. fight starts when he gets in the ring. And so they then they go, well, okay, who's your 10th guy? And at this point, they've already shaken hands. They've already had kind of a big fight. You know, they're relaxed, which if you're a fighter is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've relaxed after the fight, that's when you stiffen up. And he's like, okay, I think I got one more in me. Who is it? And lo and behold, in walks the warden. And the warden has in tow the giant Mexican guy from the first scene. And he says, what is this bullshit? And he says, well, the prison's in the county. And so you see how Guillaume was trying to get a ringer. He was trying to get a second ringer in from the second that he started. And then now what we were talking about was, even on your second time through, you said that was such a good reveal at the end, because what happens is the Mexican guy gets in the ring.
Big spoiler alert here, but yeah.
And in a callback to an earlier example of a fixed fight in the movie, Gabriel just gives a thumbs down and he takes a dive.
And he
worked for Gabriel the whole time. And so Honey Roy doesn't actually have to fight the 10th fight. There was the ringer for the ringer was a re-ringer. And Trevor says to me afterwards, that was such a shock. I couldn't believe that. That was such a good twist. And I said, was it really? And he said, well, what do you mean? And he says, well, the beginning scene is that he's using boxing as a distraction to escape from prison, right?
Which is
a felony that he wouldn't be committing if he wasn't sure the fight would last long enough and be exciting enough. And so Torres works for Gabriel from the beginning of the movie. And Trevor goes, oh, shit, you're right. It's the best example of why this whole movie is such a nice little Baroque. Like, it didn't have the money. Like, the dialogue, there's a quality to it that is not the quality that you would get out of, like, The Lady Killers. You know, it's not super polished dialogue, but it is really fun dialogue. They seem like guys you'd actually go to the bar with. And it's just a nice little buttoned up, bottled up game of one-upsmanship.
Hi, I'm Scott.
I'm Frank.
And we host the podcast Rebootleggers, where we come up with ridiculous reboots for movies and TV shows that no one asked for.
Like, what if Friends was an anime?
Or what if Terminator 2 was a high school play?
What if The Giving Tree was a dystopian trilogy?
Find us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you get podcasts from, every other Wednesday.
What if the Golden Girls were all Russian spies?
Yeah, dude, I think they get it.
What if the Shaggy Dog was a space opera?
Okay.
What if the Boxcar Children were hipsters? What if Ancient Aliens is a documentary?
At the beginning of the movie, we don't need to be told that Kane knows his way around a boxing ring, and we don't need to know that he knows his way around the fighters. We've already illustrated that, and also at the same time illustrated that he's busting people out of prison, and that he can both rig a fight and bust somebody out of prison at the same time. So he's clever, he's smart, he's resourceful, and he knows what he's doing. So there's the scene in the beginning where he's talking to Tex Cobb, and Tex Cobb's like, here, will you take this shirt to my dog? And I want my dog to smell my scent. And James Woods does it, even though it's actually kind of counter to his purposes. And so that paints him as the grifter with the heart of gold. We start to like this guy. And then we introduce this subplot where Guillaume is the one who drugged Charles Macon Diggs and made him an invalid. Casts that whole side of the plot as really bad guys. They took somebody's, you know, faculties away from them. For the sake of profit. And so, by and large, even though James Woods is kind of a colossal dickhead in this movie, he's still better than Bruce Dern's character. And all of that is set up and paid off so well. Like, again, it's an example of show, don't tell. But at the same time, I do have to confess I almost needed to watch this movie twice to get everything. Because there are certain parts in this movie where I wasn't entirely sure who's in on the grift, how deep does the grift go, is this guy an actual ringer, or is he a double ringer? Like, there's a lot going on that doesn't really get revealed until the end and you start making connections. It's not Oscar caliber. It's like you said, it's not the Coen brothers. But, you know, for a Saturday night watch, you could do a heck of a lot worse, for sure.
Yeah, I actually want to, at some day in the future, I want to compare and contrast this one with another fighty movie I want to cover, which is Red Belt.
Oh, yeah.
Red Belt is a David Mamet movie about a rigged professional fight that goes like... It goes too far and gets too baroque, and you actually do like literally kind of lose track of who's on what side and how they all know each other.
Yeah.
But it has really good performances. They're just a little incoherent. Like you have trouble actually kind of following what's going on at a couple points.
Sure.
It'd make a really good double feature with this. I'll put it that way. But
so ultimately, Matt, at the end of
It's the better film, but Digstown is the better movie.
All right, Matt. Well, ultimately, how did Digstown leave you?
I give it a 80 and a half.
80 and a half. Now, is that 80 and one half of one? Or is 80. That...
80.5, correct.
Yeah, you're not 85, you're 80.5.
Yeah, yeah.
FM, the Geech. And
I would never give this a full 82.
You know, I think Rotten Tomatoes kind of rates anything above a 50% as being, at least positive, if not fresh. And I believe this movie, just with a handful of mostly contemporary reviews, is sitting at about a 57%. I think that's really unfair. This is well over the hump for me. If we're going on a full 100-point Matt granularity scale, I'm going to go so high as I'd probably go a 78.
Huh. Three and a half whole points lower.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Well, you know, I'm just not a sports guy. However, important note before we actually wrap things up, the director on this is Michael Ritchie. No relation to Guy, but Michael Ritchie, you're going to know him from films like Fletch and Fletch Lives, which also features Tex Cobb. The Golden Child with Eddie Murphy. The Bad
also
News
also features Tex Cobb, by the way.
The Bad News Bears.
Tex Cobb is the simple cult member that lets the Golden Child go.
Oh, that's right. And then we've got the Bad News Bears, classic film. And he also has a story credit on Cool Runnings, and he was kind of known for a run of sports films. Obviously, Fletch and The Golden Child don't quite factor in there, but he had Downhill Racer in 1969. He had The Bad News Bears after that. He had the football film Semi-Tough. He had Digstown and that writing credit on Cool Runnings. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. He died of prostate cancer in 2001, but... all of those movies are movies that I enjoy. Like, I like The Bad News Bears. I like Digstown. I like, you know. So here's my question for you, Matt. And I know that the proper answer is both. But if we're going to ask this question, is this a crime heist movie or is this a sports movie? And I'm going to qualify this by saying... It is 1992, you are working in a mom-and-pop video store, and the choice has to be made of what sticker to put on the VHS box. Which one do you go with?
I'm actually going to go sports, because I think the moral core of this movie has to do with winning and losing like an adult, which is actually what happens at the end is Guillaume tries to welch on the bet, and it's his own son that kicked everything off. Who was, by the way, prepared to hand over the keys to his Corvette because he lost the bet. His Corvette that he just got on his birthday was about to hand it to Fitz that didn't even need it when his dad got involved, right? It is him who calls his father out and says, "Dad, you lost. You lost fair and square. Just give up. It's done. And it's also, there is a strong, even though it's nonverbal, there is a strong through line of sort of Roy respecting, what happened to Diggs, and he wants to put right what Guillaume did, and so there's this mano a mano, like sort of connection where he's like he's like writing, because he came up in boxing at a time when boxing was very dirty. He wants to write a thing that happened and correct that scorecard and make the world of boxing a little bit more about just boxing. Mm-hmm. You know, so because of those elements, I would nudge it over into sports. What about you?
The bottom line here is that the bet, our one guy can beat your 10 guys. Honey Roy Palmer actually does really do something that's quite impossible. Like, the number of fights that wind up he has to fight straight are enough that they would have put how old did they say he was in the movie? 48?
He is canonically 48, I believe.
And
Lou Gossett Jr. was 52.
Yeah, Louis Gossett Jr. was actually quite a bit older than Honey Roy Palmer is in the script. And there is an undeniable feat that happens on screen over the course of this film. That makes me want to say sports film. However, Palmer doesn't really win fair and square. He does have at least two fighters take a dive on him, and another one was doped through laxatives.
The second guy they paid off, though, is the brother of the dead guy. And what Guillen actually does is after the younger brother puts on the bad fight, we should actually amend our trigger warning. They're the two black guys in the cast, mm-hmm. other than Honey Roy. Well, and Hagen, but they take the younger brother and they lynch him, and they put him on a chair with a noose around his neck, and they tell the older brother that if he doesn't, I believe he's told to kill him if he can. That if Honey Roy Palmer walks out of the boxing ring after their fight, they're going to hang his little brother. And so then that's what he says, is he says, what's with these two brothers? The one won't start and the other one won't stop. So he has to fight the older brother fair and square. He has to fight the kind of barfly guy fair and square. He has to fight, we should mention this is a notable early role for one Jim Jesus Caviezel.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, holler to the big man himself, JC. And by JC, we do not mean the Lord. We mean the man who played the Lord, Jim Caviezel. Passion of the Christ fame, and I'm more fond of his turn in Count of Monte Cristo, but he is one of the kind of the soft-skulled kids that was brought up under Guillaume.
Yeah, and so, and then there's, so of the fights, he has, and then one guy is way overweight.
Mm.
Like he's like 6'8 and 380 pounds or something. So, of the quote unquote fair fights, they're all a little bit sketchy to begin with. So like really nobody, you don't actually make a fight where a guy has a 150 pound weight advantage. It's just not done.
Yeah.
And unless that guy is a friend of the show, Brad McHarg, and it's Fantastic Fest.
But the one thing I did want to point out is immediately following the climax of the film, after I think it's either that last fight. Yeah, it's after the last fight. Bruce Dern looks at James Woods and says, "You won fair and square," which is not entirely true because they're both cheating. But I think what that is the concession.
No. Trevor. Honey Roy Palmer didn't win fair and square.
Exactly.
Gabriel did.
Exactly. He was the better con man.
He was the better person at rigging boxing. Yeah.
So that to me says con crime movie. But if I was putting the sticker on the VHS box today, I would probably put it under sports, just because the VHS box for this, I actually have a vivid memory of, is very boxing focused.
The cover of it that accompanies it now is this terrible late 90s color.
Oh God.
It's like yellow and purple.
Oh no.
Should we do an if then on this?
Yeah, I actually had a couple for this. Now I just have to remember what they were. I definitely say one of my recommendations is The Music Man, which is it's a golden age musical, but if you are in for people kind of rolling into town and working grist, Harold Hill and the Buddy Hackett character in The Music Man are not unlike James Woods and Oliver Platt in this film.
Well, you got trouble, my friend. right here. I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help you cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to give an ironclad leave to yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? But just as I say it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to score in a pop-line game, I say that any boo can take and shove a ball in a pocket. And I call that sloth the first big step on the road to the depths of degradation. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon, then beer from a bottle. And the next thing you know, your son is playing for money in a pinchback suit and listening to some big out-of-town Jasper hearing him tell about horse race gambling. Not a wholesome trotting race, no, but a race where they set down right on the horse. Like to see some stuck-up jockey boy setting on Dan Patch.
Another one that actually came to mind is, if you think about the scene that you were talking about, Matt, where they like setting up the fight and setting up the rules, what defines a day, what defines a Digstown man, there's a lot of that type of conversation going on in the Joel Schumacher film, A Time to Kill. And there is kind of a B note or an underplot that deals in not necessarily jury manipulation, but jury choice and, you know, getting the jury list early and running it through. We know this guy's a racist because this. We know this guy abhors the death penalty because of this. You get a lot of that there, kind of, you know, trying to stack the game to your advantage, and also features in a very similar role one Oliver Platt as Harry Rex Vonner. So that was another recommendation from me. And also, I don't know what it is specifically that tickles this part of my brain, but this has a strong run-through thread of it, where I'm thinking movies Cool Hand Luke or even The Dirty Dozen, you know, things like that. Just they have kind of a similar flavor. And I think it's kind of that the one man standing up against many folktale kind of aspect of it. And so, like, I honestly walked away from this movie both times after having watched it, wanting to watch about five other films.
I'm going to do three, all right, that are sort of in this vein, boxing movies, in order of increasing. I'm going to start with the comedy, move toward the drama, right? I'm going to go with The Great White Hype, which is a Samuel L. Jackson, Jeff Goldblum, Damon Wayans. It's a story about a... Damon Wayans is a kind of Muhammad Ali, Anderson Silva type champ that is so good that no one will pay to watch him fight anymore. And so his management kind of deliberately lets him get like out of shape. And then they build up a Chuck Wepner, Rocky Balboa type, you know, Italian stallion type fighter who is very, very like within a hair of essentially being Vanilla Ice. So he beat the champ in the amateurs and then quit boxing and never turned pro. And now he's the front man for a grunge band. And so they find this guy and they clean him back up and they detox him and convince the world that he's a passable contender. And just so that they have a narrative for their next pay-per-view. And it has Goldblum as like a manager with just no scruples. And Samuel L. Jackson is kind of a thinly veiled jab at Don King. And like, it's not a great movie, but the entire cast just delivers very valid one-liners the whole time. Like I would put it in that half-baked tier of like not great filmmaking, but quotable. Then the next one I'll do is Gladiator.
Oh, okay.
Not the Russell Crowe one.
Oh!
Gladiator was also from 92, and it had what was the kid's name? James Marshall, who was at one point, you know, he was Jimmy in Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in A Few Good Men, and for a while there he had some heat. This might have cost him some of that heat. but this is a movie of two... he's the new guy in town, kind of Karate Kid style, and he makes friends with Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character, and the two of them, you know, they're good street fighters, and they get involved in kind of a gray market boxing promotion run by Brian Dennehy, who is a disgraced heavyweight champion in his own right, and It's just a fun, zippy little action movie. It's got some painfully 90s sequences in it. Some quality early hip hop. And by quality, I mean cringy. and it's just a fun one that is just kind of a pure, like, I kind of like martial arts movies that are just about a fight where there's not that much of a hustle involved.
Uh-huh.
And, some of that is here where it's just kind of a pure hard-headedness situation. It's just a nice basic boxing, grimy boxing movie.
Okay.
Right. It's something I pulled up out of my memory hole so that I wouldn't have to nominate a Rocky, because we talk about Rocky enough. and the third one is an older movie, which I have a copy of that is titled The Boxer.
Uh-huh.
But IMDb tells me it was released most widely under the name The Big Man, which is the name of the novel that it's based on.
Uh-huh.
But it is a... it was an Irish indie movie. It's an early Liam Neeson turn. Has Liam Neeson, Billy Connolly in it, who in it is one of our finest living storytellers when he's not being the Boondock Saints dad.
Ladies and gentlemen, your champion, the big man, Danny Scullera. There's none fight longer. There's none fight harder.
I was a minor. 13 years.
I see you have a criminal record, Mr. Scullera.
Not a criminal record, a political record.
What we have here is a fight to the finish.
So that's your man.
That's him, Mr. Mason. Man of principle. Best. The big man. I tell you, Mr. Mason, he's all yours.
A word with you, sir.
A bet. It must have been a bet.
In advance. I'm earning it.
Like a job?
A job.
I think the big man's all he's cracked up to be, huh?
Just what sort of job is it?
Bare knuckles, son. No feet, no body, no kicking.
Let's just pack up and go.
Too late.
It's interesting to me because it's one of the only real explorations I've ever seen of what it sort of like, the sort of interesting social things that happen to you if you're known to be good at fighting, and how everybody starts putting shit on you when you book a fight. And it is about an underground Irish boxing match, bare knuckle fight. These gangsters want to watch a bare knuckle fight. And so they press this retired boxer into it. And, they find some other parolee for him to fight. And the actual fight is really grim. He ends up blinding the guy in one eye. And then he can't live with himself. And he goes and it feels like he has to support the other boxer after the match. And that it adds to his burdens instead of relieving anything by winning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very, very kind of like James Joyce kind of 70s Irish story. And it's just interesting because it's one of the only, because like, I don't know, you're a big guy. I'm a big guy. Sometimes we're out at the bar.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're out at the bar and our friends get lippier. You know?
Yeah.
I've had a friend at the bar getting some shit, turn around and look at me. And I'm like, ah, dude, I'll tell you what, I'm going to keep him from killing you. But you're on your own for the first 3 minutes. I'm not going to get you out of stuff like this all the time.
Probably worth mentioning before we close out that Dickstown in and of itself is based on a book, Dickstown Ringers by Leonard Wise, which I'm going to confess, Matt, I know nothing about.
I've never heard of the guy. I bought the book. I'm a little bit of the way through it. It's pulpy. Like somewhere in the Mickey Spillane neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just kind of a, you know, it's, I won't say a dime store. I'll say a truck stop novel. It's just a, you know, one of those, kind of noir stories that came out by the bushel in the '80s. It's not quite good enough. Like I wouldn't compare it to Robert Parker or Elmore Leonard or anybody, but it reads good. It's the plot from the movie told slower.
Well, and I will also say, as far as an if-then recommendation, I totally missed this one and I feel like an idiot for it. The Sting, which we actually already have done an episode on. So if you're a big fan of the grift and the kind of the long con with the almost Agatha Christie level of dropping hints for you to pick up along the way, episode 33 of the Nighthawks podcast discuss The Sting, as well as Butch and Sundance, which is a fantastic movie as well. So put those on your to-watch list.
Do you watch anything lately?
I've been reading a lot, honestly. I mean, what I will say is I have read, I have been kind of taking a minute and trying to expand my horizons, reading things that are outside of my wheelhouse. I was a big fiction reader, didn't read a lot of nonfiction, so I'm trying to read a lot of nonfiction this year. And I've read two autobiographies that are tied in with Hollywood. Mara Wilson's autobiography
I love her.
It's a touching autobiography, pulls on the heartstrings in a couple places, makes you laugh in a couple more, makes you think and get pensive. Just a really solid, very quick read. And then I also read by Gianni Russo, who played the kind of brother-in-law in The Godfather. He has an autobiography about his life kind of growing up mob adjacent and curtailing that into an acting career and a career as a club owner in Las Vegas that ended up getting him in a little bit of hot water. But the interesting thing between the two of these is I do have to admit, reading Gianni Russo's book, there were a couple of times where my eyebrows climbed to the top of my head and I said, I don't know how much I believe this. The beautiful part about that is Gianni Russo does not give a shit what I believe. And so you have to read it and take it for what it's worth. It's a Chuck Barris story. You can enjoy the story for what's being told, whether or not you believe it's up to you. Mara Wilson, on the other hand, I found a lot more credible.
You doubt my inner mythology is part of my inner mythology, brother.
So I'd recommend both of those. They were fun reads. I will say that Gianni Russo gets a little blue at times, and he is definitely a New York Italian from a certain period in time, and he writes just like he talks, and that should give you all the preparation you need.
I'm just thinking of Gianni Russo, man. Just see this Conicello? Got this from my dad. It's going to go to my son. You know, just Italian to the bone. But I went to the new Annabelle movie.
So you've been keeping up on those. Does the new one bring anything new to the table? Is it a worthy entry?
It's pretty fun. It's the Annabelle spinoff. Like the last one, I think, is the, what is it, Annabelle
Creation? Is that where they left off?
Creation. That's probably the single best entry in the Conjuring universe, in my opinion. If you had to just judge them all as standalone movies and rank them, it is the scariest, and it has the best mythology and the most import, you know. This one is not quite as good, but it's worthy. It happens in the Warren's house, if you're following that franchise. They leave to do an exorcism or something in another state and have to hire a babysitter. And it is the two girls, their preteen daughter and the two girls that are taking care of her, are terrorized by the haunted objects in the basement.
Uh-huh.
Including one Annabelle who gets out at one point and runs amok. And so it is very, I mean, there's, it has a more Sam Raimi feel, because all the evil objects are, you know, when the babysitter's not looking directly at them, they move and crawl around. And at one point they all start kind of rattling and attacking her at once. And so it's a very, a little bit more of like a James Wan movie mated with a Sam Raimi movie,
mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, it was worth the ticket price. It was a decent horror movie. I also saw the new Child's Play,
and
I'm really conflicted. Has some fun practical gore, and the child actor is better than the original Andy. Sorry, dude, if you're out there. And his relationship with the doll is kind of more developed,
mm-hmm.
because the doll is supposed to be like a rogue AI. Like it's an AI relaunch of the Buddy doll that has learning capability, and a disgruntled worker was fired at the factory. So he turns the safeguards off, and you get a doll that is free to grow up and become Chucky. So the early part where he's like, he's a kid in a new town. He's almost too old to have a My Buddy.
Mm-hmm.
But he just moved to a new town, so it's kind of his only friend. And it's you know, the upgraded, the modern upgraded doll is kind of a digital pet. So it can actually, like, it can play checkers with him, and it can throw a ball back and forth, and it can, so it really is his only friend for a little bit after he moves. And then after he makes human friends, it gets more and more estranged as he plays with it less and less, until he's kind of neglecting it and locking it up in a wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts to get stalkery. So it's more of a, like, almost a single white female kind of thing.
Mm.
Until the end, and they have a big climax in a toy store when he's going to upload his rogue code into all the other home automation that the company makes.
Uh-huh.
So he'll be in everybody's house, and he'll be in all the buddy dolls, and the buddy dolls are diverse. So they come in all shapes and sizes, and including, like, some that are anthropomorphic.
Uh-huh.
And the teddy bear ones look like little Lon Chaney werewolves. And I will say, I would, if you are a practical gore fan, find time for, like, a reduced value ticket to this.
Uh-huh.
Because it does have some great gore in it. It is, in my opinion, it's weaker than what the since we recently rewatched the original Child's Play, I can't say that if the two of them were released today, I'd say Child's Play 1 is better than Child's Play Redo. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I just didn't feel as much from the robot doll. It just wasn't as scary as Charles Lee Ray that wanted Andy's body, you know. And then the subsequent mythology of the latter day Chucky movies that have sort of ascended to high camp, you know. it's not the seed of any. It will never be that.
Yeah.
You know, and I just, not enough Brad Dourif, you know.
Yeah. Well, Don Mancini.
I give this like a, I'm going to say C minus.
Okay.
This should have worked with the original people and made it really good, but they didn't. Effects crew earned every dollar. Turn your brain off. And if you want to turn your brain off and watch people die, it's great.
All righty. Well, I think that's about going to wrap it up for me. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts. You can find us on Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Be sure to check out the other shows on the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network, now celebrating 1 year of partnership with us at the Nighthawks Podcast. So, Matt, I think that's it for me.
This is Precious Roy, and this podcast is over. We're going to go now, because it's almost morning.
Sit at WoW.
Hey there! Are you queer or some variation of it? Well, I'm Chris, and this is my co-host,
Adam.
And welcome to Cinema Queens,
where we talk about queer cinema.
Each week, we watch beloved queer classics, discuss them, review them,
and cover a whole cluster of topics from our favorite scenes,
what they mean to us,
how it relates to our current world,
and the best part, the cherry on top of the sundae, happens to be
gay rants!
So prepare your ear holes!
Hey, listen to us, Queens, talk cinema. New episodes drop every Monday on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher.
Bye-bye!
God. Close ain't gonna make it, man.
Okay, look. He's bigger than you are. He's tougher. He's faster. He's younger than you are. He hasn't fought 22 rounds today, but you remember this. You are black.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to inspire you. You know, it's a roots kind of thing. It's like a motivation thing.
Well, you're a shit motivation.